Today on Maine Calling, is peace possible in the Middle East? Conflict in the Middle East rages on, even as peace talks are underway. After 2 days of negotiations last week, President Biden asserted that progress is being made toward the proposed ceasefire plan. That plan, which Biden outlined back in May, includes Hamas's release of hostages and Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. But escalating turmoil in the region makes it hard to imagine that a peaceful resolution is possible. I'm Cindy Hahn. We'll talk with global affairs experts about ongoing attacks in Gaza, where the death toll has surpassed 40,000. And we'll discuss whether the heightened tensions between Israel and Iran might spiral into a wider war. Is there a peaceful solution for the Middle East? And what is the role of the United States? Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working this summer to purchase and protect the historic Morris Farm in Wiscasset. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org. By Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Peace talks continue this week in the Middle East after initial negotiations last week have left significant gaps. Today, we'll talk about the prospects for a ceasefire agreement and for de-escalation of the highly charged conflict in the region. My guests are Jackie Northam, NPR's international affairs correspondent. She focuses on foreign policy and global economics. And Aaron David Miller is a Middle East analyst, author, and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We invite you to join the conversation. Share your questions about the conflict in the Middle East. Email talk at mainepublic.org, post a comment on our Facebook or Instagram pages, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And an additional note that next week, Jackie Northam and Aaron David Miller, along with journalist Martin Fletcher, will address the question, can there be peace in the Middle East in our lifetimes? That event will be on August 27th at the Freeport Performing Arts Center. Visit our website or freeportspeech.org for more information. And Jackie, I'm going to start with you. The peace talks are still underway in the Middle East after last week, 2 days of negotiations that President Biden said left him optimistic and, quote, we are closer than we've ever been. Is that a realistic assessment of where the progress has been made so far and its talks start up again today?
I think the administration is putting a pretty good spin on this. There is still a lot of distance between the two sides, Hamas and Israel. We have Secretary of State Antony Blinken currently in Israel right now. He met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for about 2.5 hours today. The military chief, Yoav Gallant, and several other senior Israeli officials trying to get this peace deal over the finish line here. But again, there's a long way away between the two sides. And, you know, and all of this in the background is this real concern throughout the region that Iran might strike in retaliation for the assassination of a senior Hamas leader a couple weeks ago, right in the heart of Tehran. He was staying at a government guest house. They blame Israel for the attack, and they have vowed, the Iranian government has vowed to retaliate. It hasn't happened yet. They said the whole region is just bracing for this to happen. Iran said that it will hold off if they can get a ceasefire underway. So there's added impetus to get this thing done. But again, the two sides are still a long way away on several critical points.
It's so charged and so complicated right now, as you say. Aaron, if you can back up a little for us and just say, tell us what the goals of the peace talks were, the three-phase ceasefire proposal that was outlined by President Biden that now I guess the goalposts are changing, but start there if you can.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for having me. I mean, Colin, it's a great show and it's wonderful to be here with Jackie. You know, I quibble, I think, with the phrase peace talks. That's not what this is about. That's what it's never been about this, at least since October 7th. This is about whether or not two combatants who are engaged in an existential and or near existential struggle with one another, led by two key decision makers who have a variety of motives that go beyond simply agreeing to this proposal or not. That's Yahya Sinwar, the key Palestinian decision maker, now the unchallenged leader of Hamas, ensconced somewhere in a tunnel below Khan Yunis and Rafah, surrounded by roughly 115 hostages, 40 plus of whom the Israelis believe were killed on October 7, their bodies brought back to Gaza to trade, or they died in captivity, and Benjamin Netanyahu, a man whose worldview is defined by how to maintain himself in power, or he faces a potential conviction in his bribery, fraud, and breach of trust trial that's been ongoing now for 4 years, or a plea deal that will drive him out of politics. This is about whether or not, in my judgment, if there is a deal and phase one, I doubt if you'll get beyond phase one. And phase one is a limited exchange of hostages for an asymmetrical number of Palestinian prisoners. I've heard the ratio is 50 to one, many of whom have been charged with killing Israelis, and a 6 week ceasefire, which is no small or mean accomplishment. It would provide an opportunity to surge on a predictable and reliable basis the kinds of assistance that would begin to deal with the traumas that the vast majority of the Palestinian people, exponential rise of Palestinian deaths and the humanitarian catastrophe that they've suffered. So that's the objective here. And last point I would make, my experience in Arab-Israeli negotiations over a 20-plus year period is that they have two speeds, slow and slower. And they succeed only when each party believes that the incentives for closing the deal outweigh the benefits of the status quo. And I just don't think that either Yahya Sinwar or Benjamin Netanyahu are in all that much of a hurry. The party that's in a hurry, of course, is the Biden administration.
If I could just jump in just for a second there, though, there is pressure on Netanyahu, for one thing, to wrap this deal up because the US, also the Israeli military, are saying they cannot get the hostages back through military means alone. And in fact, they're saying, Sinyar is probably surrounded in this tunnel, deep in this tunnel somewhere, by hostages right now, that the Israeli military has done as much as it can in Gaza. And if they want the hostages back, they're going to have to come to some deal. I came back from Israel. It's my third time since October 7th in May. And, you know, the street protests by the families of the hostages, this is a powerful voice in Israel. But as Aaron said, you know, Netanyahu's calculations are really more about political survival right now than probably, who knows, maybe than the hostages themselves.
I think Jackie makes a fair point, but I'd only add, even if you got a phase one, that leaves 50 hostages in Yahya Sinwar's control. We're not talking about returning all of the hostages, because Sinwar's price for that is a permanent cessation of hostilities and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. And Benjamin Netanyahu, who, by the way, absolutely is under pressure, as Jackie has said, by the hostage families, by the international community, by the United States. But there is no effective opposition in Israel to unseat him. Elections are due to, I mean, aren't due until 2026. He has 64 seats and 120 seat Israeli parliament in the Knesset. It's an incredibly tight, coherent, ultra-right religious coalition, which frankly, to quote Sam Adams, one of our revolutionary figures, we're either all going to hang separately or we're going to hang together. So I think Jackie is absolutely correct. And I'm not ruling out the possibility of a deal, even within the next week, but it will only be for phase one.
And will it stick if there is a deal? If it happens this week, then how long would a deal hold?
6 weeks is what the three-phase Israeli plan, announced by the president on May 31st and ensconced in a UN security resolution, calls for roughly six week ceasefires. So you probably would, even though ceasefires in this region are made to be broken, I think you probably would get through 6 weeks. The Israeli Defense Forces are pressing the prime minister. They need a break. The real threat that they face is in the north. They'd like to stabilize the situation in Gaza. Humanitarian assistance could then pour into Gaza, not dribble into Gaza. And you'd get, as I said, a limited exchange. That's the women, that's the elderly, and that's the infirm. But the male hostages, those who are IDF members and civilians, Sinwar will not give them back until he gets what he wants. And what he wants, I think, is not doable.
And Jackie, first of all, I know you need to clarify your position as not only an NPR correspondent, but a Middle East expert from your own experiences. So I'm going to let you, Sena, sort of explain that part to the audience.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, I've been going to the Middle East now for four decades, and it sure has changed. It's changed a lot. Frankly, it's just got worse with a couple moments of hope there and that. But I am not a spokesperson for NPR. I'm in here as, my limited capacity to come and talk on your show. And that's fine. But yeah, no, I've been going there a long time. I've spent a lot of time in the Gulf region, North Africa, everything like that. So, but I do cover the rest of the world as well. So,
okay. Yeah. Wanted you to be able to say that. But back to what Aaron was saying with the hostages, is this the last chance for a hostage deal? These negotiations?
Well, it's a little bit surprising, but that's what the U.S. has been saying today. Secretary Blinken said this is probably the best and maybe the last opportunity to achieve a ceasefire and hostage release deal. And that sounds pretty finite, especially if you're Secretary of State, because you're always supposed to be working towards something. And I don't know if this doesn't work. What is the U.S. thinking now? But this is important to the administration. This is in some ways President Biden's legacy, if he can get this ceasefire deal done. So the push is enormous. And it's not just the U.S. This latest sort of massaging of the proposal involves Qatar and Egypt. There's a real importance in the whole region that this cease, this fighting stop. And again, with Iran looming in the background as well. So I don't know if this is the last opportunity. I suspect if it doesn't work, they'll go back to the drawing board and try something else. There's just simply too much riding on it.
Aaron, I just want to ask you a maybe simple question, but you've been involved as a negotiator before. So when we read the paper, hear about what's happening over there, what is actually, can you paint a picture for us on how these negotiations work? Are they sitting at a table hashing things out, or how does it actually work?
Remember, I've never been experienced a negotiation quite like this. This is not by any stretch of the imagination. There's never been a negotiation like this in the Middle East. As I mentioned, the key Palestinian decision maker, the only Palestinian who counts, because he holds hostages and he can actually offer to restrict or end Hamas's military activity, is Yahya Sinwar. He hasn't been at the table or in direct contact face to face, even with his own negotiating team. How they're communicating with one another, with the Israelis monitoring SIGINT, signal intelligence, in effort to identify where he is so that they can eliminate him, is a mystery to me. 11 months, and they still have not been able to locate him. So this is all being done by proxies, by cutouts. There are Hamas negotiators, one of whom they're actually more facilitators or mailmen than they are actually negotiating, because they're doing exactly what Sinwar wants them to do. They're based in Doha. The external leadership is based in Doha. So the Qataris, the prime minister, the Egyptian head of intelligence, David Barnea, who's head of the Mossad, and Bill Burns, head of CIA, gather either in Doha or Cairo. The Americans, of course, do not engage directly, even with the Hamas cutouts. Those are done in proximity talks. presumably in the same hotel or in adjacent hotels. So the Americans work out arrangements with the Israelis, the Qataris and the Egyptians are involved. They take the latest proposals and they brief Hamas's external leadership, who find some way of communicating with Yahya Sinwar. So this is it's quite remarkable, and incredibly discouraging, because I think it obviously adds to the challenges and difficulties. There is no trust and confidence, to say the least. You have two parties who would love to see one another completely obliterate. This is not Israel and Egypt. This is not Israel and Syria. This is not a negotiation between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. It's a negotiation between the most right-wing government in Israel's history and an organization that's the embodiment of an idea, which is the replacement of Israel by an Islamic State. And it's on the US list of foreign terrorist organizations. And it holds hostages, including as many as eight Americans. So it's not a traditional negotiation. I would argue it's also one of the reasons the US, I think, has been reluctant and has refused to impose real pressure on the Israelis, is because it's not a conflict between Israel and Egypt. There's going to be no Sadats and Menachem Begins that are going to sign a peace treaty. It's not Assad and Barak negotiating over the future of the Golan Heights. It's an asymmetrical negotiation where the US, I believe, is very constrained because of the nature of Hamas and its own and the hostages.
Okay, it is time to take a quick break. After the break, we'll go to a caller from Lance, calling from Elliott. This is Maine Calling. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Our topic today, whether there is a path to peace in the Middle East or is a wider war in store for the region, and the role of the United States in the conflict. Joining me, Jackie Northam, international affairs correspondent for NPR, and Aaron David Miller, Middle East expert and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on our Facebook page or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And on the line with us now is Lance, calling in from Elliott. Hi, Lance. What did you want to ask?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a U.S. citizen, former military. I've traveled to Israel extensively. My son and my ex are still in Israel. But all due respect to your guest, there is a major disconnect with how we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Secretary Blinken's visit is not going to be looked at as sincere until people start talking about whether or not Israeli settlers and Orthodox settlers still continue to expand in Palestinian territory, whether or not both sides agree that to look at each other and say both have a right to a two-state solution and sovereignty. Until we don't have a separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, where cousins and families are literally separated by miles from each other and can't see each other, there's a separate but equal going on in Israel, almost like the 1960s here in America, and everyone refuses to acknowledge it. And I've traveled to Israeli, both Arab and Israeli territory extensively, and it's like walking around with blinders on, where there's an elephant in the room that no one talks about. Until they do, this conflict, this war will go away. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments and questions, Lance. Jackie, go ahead.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. I mean, if you're talking, I spend a lot of time out in the West Bank when I go to Israel, certainly. And the building of settlements over the years since I've been going there is quite remarkable, and it's continuing to happen now, and they're considered internationally illegal. But you also have members of Netanyahu's government, well, hard right-wing ultra-nationalist members who are senior figures in his government, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is the national security minister, and then Bezalel Smotrich, who is the finance minister, two of the key ones that are pushing for more settlements at this point. So how can anybody, I guess if you're a Palestinian, how can you have sort of faith in a two-state solution when the land is being gobbled up for all intents and purposes? There's been a lot of violence out in the West Bank since October 7th, since the terror attack on by Hamas on Israel. About 600 Palestinians have been killed by settlers. There's been more than 1,200 attacks. And for the most part, there isn't a lot of help from either the Israeli military or the Israeli police. They just stand back and let it happen. So this is something that has not really been addressed. The US has sanctioned a few of the settlers now, but if this has to get sorted out before I think anybody's going to have faith in it. There was a survey that just came out last week, and it was talking about both sides. For Israelis, only about 20% now believe in a two-state solution, that the two sides can live side by side. And that was the same on the Palestinian side as well. So your caller is right.
Aaron, did you want to add to that?
You know, I'd only add that during the 90s, not that no one paid attention to the or actually even pursued negotiations leading to a two-state solution. At Camp David in July, this is ancient history now, in July of 2000, I was one of the 12 Americans who were there. President Clinton brought Ehud Barak, the Prime Minister of Israel, Yasser Arafat, Chairman of the PLO, together at Camp David for a 2-week summit in which the five core issues that bound the question of two states, border security, refugees, Jerusalem, and the end of all the adjudication of all claims were addressed. The gaps between the Israelis and Palestinians in July of 2020 were enormous. They were Grand Canyon-like in their character. And there's a certain reality here that, you know, it's inconvenient and it's unpleasant to address. But every time there has been progress in the Arab-Israeli conflict, it has been when you had leaders who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their ideologies, leaders who understand that they need to do this because it's in the best interest of their people. Sadat and Menachem Begin, King Hussein, and the late Prime Minister Rabin of Israel, even Yasser Arafat and Rabin in Arafat's first incarnation. But you don't have those kinds of leaders. They're nowhere to be found. You cannot pursue a serious two-state solution with the current leadership in Israel or with the current leadership of the Palestinian Authority, which controls no more than 40% of the West Bank. How this is going to play out in the wake of October 7 with two traumatized communities, my real fear is that when this is done, when the shooting finally stops, Israelis and Palestinians are going to look at one another and they're going to say this: you know, it's not that we don't understand one another, it's that we understand one another only too well. And the space for pursuing what, in my judgment, and the caller is correct, the least bad outcome, two states, the space for pursuing that is going to be is going to contract. And that's the, I think that's the real tragedy here. Violence and war and insurgency have preceded every single breakthrough in the Arab-Israeli conflict, without exception. And this time around, I just don't see October 7 and what it's produced providing the kind of counter to that trauma.
Yeah. If I could just add, in its most basic, what you're looking here at right now is you've got Hamas that does not recognize Israel and carried out this attack. On the other side, you have Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has said point blank that he does not want two-state solution. He has said that in the past. So where do you go from there? I agree with Aaron 100%. This is probably the darkest time. I've been going there 40 years. It's probably the darkest time that I can imagine. Having said that, the first assignment that I had with NPR's foreign desk was the Second Intifada. That was really bleak. Somehow pulled back, and we got. But I don't. It just it looks so dire right now that even if they get a ceasefire, I just don't know how it proceeds from here. It's really bleak right now.
Yeah, Aaron, I wanted to ask you too, with Netanyahu repeatedly defining his goals as total victory over Hamas. What does that mean when he says totally eradicating Hamas? There's no end point to that. So talk about what your assessment is of how achievable or non-achievable that is.
As I mentioned before, when we talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, you cannot but link much of his tactics and strategy to his political predicament. So total, if you define the war as total victory, well, then what? That means the war goes on. And while I don't think Netanyahu wants a major regional war, I think he'd be quite content to continue to pursue and have the Israeli Defense Forces continue to pursue their efforts to eradicate Hamas's organized military capacity. Let's be clear. Hamas is an idea. It's the organizational embodiment of an idea. It's a very objectionable idea. And you can't kill an idea, but you can make an idea much less relevant. And here is where I think there's been a major strategic failing, mostly, I would add, on this issue, on the Israeli side. Because if you want to ultimately defeat Hamas, you have to create an alternative. That means an alternative governing structure that has credibility, that can deliver security, and that can deliver prosperity and fundamentally change the condition of the Gaza Strip, which even under the best of circumstances has been incredibly restrictive and oppressive. So that, I think, is a core question. But again, it comes back to domestic politics. If you want to talk about post-Gaza and a post-Hamas future, then you have to do the following. The Arab states have laid it out, and so has the Palestinian Authority. You can't have a situation in which Gaza first becomes Gaza only. There has to be a political horizon. Otherwise, the Arab states, the Emiratis, the Saudis, are not prepared to deploy Arab boots on the ground to create a security structure. And the Palestinian Authority, as weak and as feckless and as corrupt and as nepotistic as it is, an 87-year-old guy now in the fifth year of a 4-year term, you can't do it with him. But you do need a credible Palestinian governing structure. And as Jackie said, Israeli policies on the West Bank make that virtually impossible. So total victory is a slogan, it's a bumper sticker, it's not achievable. Eradicating Hamas as an organized military structure will still leave it as an insurgency, capable through intimidation and co-optation of undermining whatever Palestinian governing structure emerges. Without the political horizon, you can't get Arab state buy-in. You can't get Palestinian buy-in, and you allow Hamas, frankly, to emerge as they will emerge, whether Sinwar is killed or not, to claim victory.
I think Mike calling in from Tenants Harbor has something he wants to comment on this topic. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, and it fits right in with what your speaker was just saying. It's absolutely impossible for Netanyahu to eliminate Hamas, because what he has done is he has killed 40,000, maimed tens of thousands of others, and how many thousands of their relatives have sworn vengeance against Israel? Netanyahu is actually promoting the resurgence and continuation of Hamas. And I believe until Netanyahu is removed from power, there can be no peace in the Middle East because he won't allow it. The attacks on Syria and other places that he does are just meant to inflame things. And by inflaming them, he's going to stay in power. So I just don't see how he can say that we're going to eliminate Hamas, because you can't eliminate a guerrilla group by doing this kind of stuff. And the West Bank occupation, the Palestinians need to have their own state in order for peace to be in the Middle East. And I guess that's all I've got to say.
Okay, well, thank you for calling in, Mike, with your comments. Jackie, did you want to respond to what Mike was saying?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has warned Israel several times, its military chief and Netanyahu, that you may win the battle, but you're going to lose the war, which is basically what our caller was just saying there. You are very likely creating more militants by this carrying on as long. Again, 40,000 people dead. There's at the same time, the Palestinians just have, they're underserved by their leadership. You know, they voted Hamas in very many years ago. Gaza was a terrible place and it's worse now. But even on the West Bank, you know, you've got the Palestinian Authority, as David said, they're corrupt, they're inept, everything else like that. The Palestinians have to have a much better leader than what they've got now. The other concern too is that, you know, this spreads far beyond Israel's borders as well. If you're looking at Hezbollah in Lebanon, watching what's happening in Gaza, again, you're spawning more anger towards Israel, most likely more militancy as well. It's a very dangerous situation, but you know, there is no, Netanyahu is not going anywhere anytime soon. He's got a hard right-wing government behind him that is forcing a lot of these policies on him. And, you know, the other alternative for him is to go to jail on corruption charges. So I don't see that changing.
Okay, thank you. We have a question here from, this is a very long one from Carl. The U.S. needs to stop funding Israel's wars. Israel occupation policy does not align with my and the majority of U.S. citizens' morals. Israel in 1967 conducted a surprise unprovoked invasion of East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the entire Sinai Peninsula, seizing them all, as well as the Golan Heights, from which there was some provocation from Syria firing rockets into Israel. He sums up quite a bit more and is just, I'll let you take it from there, Aaron, in terms of just the U.S.'s role. We've touched upon it quite a bit. But what do you say to what Carl is pointing out?
Look, it's a question I'm asked repeatedly. Why in the past 11 months hasn't the Biden administration imposed a single cost or consequence on the Netanyahu government for policies it didn't like? And the answer I give is not emotionally satisfying. It may be inconvenient, but in my judgment, it is the answer to the question of why not a single cost or consequence that normal humans would regard as significant pressure has been deployed by the administration. And there are several reasons. Number one, you're dealing with an American president whose relationship with the state of Israel is unique by any standard. Joe Biden has had decades of experience, both in the Senate, where being good on Israel was essentially a key requirement of success in American politics. His father weaned he and his sibs on the Nazi Holocaust and the dangers of silence, which is equated to complicity. Joe Biden has developed an emotional bond with the idea of Israel, the people of Israel, the security of Israel, not with the Netanyahu government, which is deep. That's number one. Number two, American domestic politics. While the Democratic Party has lost considerable support among the uncommitted, for a politician like Joe Biden to basically impose serious costs and consequences on Israel, conditioning or restricting military assistance, introducing UN Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, abandoning negotiations altogether and demanding cessation of hostilities, can be politically costly. And now, with under 80 days to go before November 5th, if the administration's calculation, you see how they're comporting themselves with respect to Vice President Harris. She has been remarkably empathetic to the suffering and the rights of Palestinians, but she's made it unmistakably clear that she's not prepared to endorse an arms embargo or to sanction Israel, whatever her personal feelings may be. It could cost them, both in terms of potential donor support and give the Republicans a ready-made issue at a time when you're talking about an election that could be determined by a handful of states and the number of votes that humans it would take to fill up the University of Michigan stadium. And then there's the issue of getting a deal. The administration has made a calculation that the only way to extricate, to begin to stop this war, is through a negotiation and an agreement that both Israel and Hamas have to buy onto. So the notion that the administration is going to quit if this doesn't work out, I think is unrealistic. They'll keep on trying. But for those three reasons, I think they've been reluctant to impose any serious pressure on the Netanyahu government.
But if you look at Congress with this multiple rounds of applause for Netanyahu during the joint meeting of Congress as well. I mean, it's across the board, the support, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, let's pick up on that. We're just going to take another quick break right now. This is Maine Calling. Let us know your thoughts and concerns about what's happening in the Middle East. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the show, analysis of the conflicts between Israel and Hamas, what it means for the region and for the U.S. as well. Our guests are Aaron David Miller. He's a former negotiator for the State Department and is senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment. And Jackie Northam is international affairs correspondent for National Public Radio. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Jackie, you were talking about, following up on what Aaron was talking about, just in terms of the U.S.'s ability to influence Israel to the degree, all the protesters, tens of thousands of protesters expected at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention this week. And, you know, they're asking for action by President Biden. They're angry about his support for Israel. So if the U.S. were to agree to an arms embargo, you know, what is your take on how that would actually affect Israel?
Gosh, I'd be surprised if there was a full arms embargo. What Aaron was saying is absolutely right. I mean, what have they done so far? They're holding back one shipment of heavy weaponry, and that's it. So I would, first of all, be very, very surprised. Secondly, it could have an impact. It could have an impact. But I think, again, going back to Netanyahu, I think he's so dug in on what he's doing here that they will just pummel ahead anyway. They'll just keep going ahead. So I don't think it would really make a difference, not in the short term. As far as the DNC goes, this will be really interesting to see. One thing that's really surprised me about this conflict, and I've covered many sort of skirmishes and various uprisings in Israel before, but this one is just the extent of backlash here in the U.S. with the college protests and, you know, at dinner tables across the country, families split up, friends and that. This one has really made a difference, resonated with the American people. And I don't know whether it's just a new generation or whether it's the extent of the killing in Gaza, but I have been struck by just how powerful this time around the Israel-Gaza story has taken hold.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, how will, as you said, Vice President Kamala Harris, now presidential candidate, is walking the line by being more sympathetic to the Palestinian side than Biden has been? What do you forecast for that going forward?
You know, as Jonathan Alter said, all presidents are blind dates. And no matter how much we think we know the man and one day woman, hopefully, hold that office, you don't really know until The president is shackled with the extraordinary responsibility for both domestic and foreign policy. I think there's the inner Kamala Harris. She's of a much different generation, a different generation than Joe Biden. She's much more attuned to discrimination, to equity issues, to diversity. I think she is capable because she feels it. Not that Joe Biden is not an uncaring man, but if you looked at his statements during the course of the last 11 months, you'd be hard pressed to find any that actually convey, both in tone and feeling, the fact that there is enormous Palestinian suffering. Her statement in the wake of her meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu was quite remarkable. It was a statement that the president should have given months ago. So I think that's the inner Kamala Harris. But then there's the outer Kamala Harris, the one that has to color between the lines, because you have to do politics in the United States. And I've worked for half a dozen administrations, Democrat and Republicans. Presidents do not, by definition, like to fight with Israeli prime ministers. It can be politically damaging, it can be costly, and usually it's counterproductive. There have been occasions where the United States has, in fact, deployed pressure. But you'd have to go back literally to the Eisenhower administration, when during the Suez crisis, the president threatened to sanction Israel if it didn't withdraw its forces from Sinai. And the Israelis withdrew. Reagan delayed the shipments of F-16s three times during the Israeli-Lebanese war. My former boss, Jim Baker, during the first Bush administration, suspended $10 billion of loan guarantees to the Shamir government over Israeli settlement policies. But this conflict really goes beyond most of those pressure points. And I think that you could see a different emphasis should Kamala Harris gain the Oval Office. But the U.S.-Israeli relationship, particularly if there's a change in leadership in Israel, is quite unique in that regard. The generational divide, however, is definitely occurring. And where the U.S.-Israeli relationship goes in the years going forward is unclear. One last point, the two fundamental foundations of that relationship, the perception of value affinity, that we share common values with Israel, and the perception that we share common interests, a high degree of coincidence of values and interests, that's under severe stress in the course of the last 20 years. In large part, I would argue, it's overlapped with Benjamin Netanyahu's tenure as prime minister and the shift in Israeli politics to the right.
Jackie, before we have another caller coming in, but I just wanted, we haven't talked as much about Iran yet. You've both mentioned what's going on there with the, you know, this attacks between Hezbollah and Israel have been intensified. They've been on this brink of war and everyone's waiting to see what Iran's going to do. So, Jackie, what has kept Iran from retaliating against Israel so far? And what do you think might happen and when?
Right. Well, the thing is with the Iranians, they play their cards very, very close to the chest. So it's all speculation on everybody's part. But if you do try to read the tea leaves, it's just Iran doesn't want to get dragged into a larger regional war. And same as Hezbollah. You know, they're doing these tit for tat, attacks across the border with Israel and that, but it hasn't blown up so far. The problem is any sort of miscalculation on any one side, and it could all be a different game. It could go. But, Iran, you know, it can't afford it economically. It does not want to get involved in that. It wants a ceasefire if it can get a ceasefire. It was deeply, deeply humiliated when this Ismail Haniyeh, who was a senior Hamas leader, was assassinated right in the heart of Tehran. He had come in for the inauguration of the new president. He got taken out. Iran blames Israel. Well, it was, you know, there was a huge security breach, humiliation. Somehow it wants to retaliate for that. But it has to really walk a very fine line. It wants to retaliate, but it doesn't want to make it that bad where Israel has to respond. And in that sense, you know, you've got the US coming in. Another reason why it hasn't done it yet is just deterrence by the Mideast. In one way, it has just flooded the area with weaponry. You know, there's aircraft carriers in there now. Multiple number there, you know, fighter jets are coming in. They've got a submarine capable with and they also have done a diplomatic deterrence as well. It's got the whole region pushing Iran, you know, all its allies in the region saying, hold off, do not launch an attack. And in some ways, the US has done a very good job of deterrence that way between those two. So everybody is just bracing right now. It doesn't seem that anybody wants a broader war. Iran feels it does have to attack. But again, the problem here is if one side miscalculates, if there's some little skirmish that gets blown out of proportion, it is a whole different ball game. And it can draw in the whole region.
Okay, let's go to a call from Michael calling from Wiscasset. Hi, Michael, go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling about, well, my question or observation is more about what I see as Iranian influence being precarious outside its spheres of influence within the Arab Shiite community. I mean, their support for Hamas is sort of that old cliche, the enemy of my enemy is my enemy. But ultimately, there's a fundamental philosophical, theological disagreement between Hamas being, you know, Sunnis in line with the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course, Shia Iran.
Okay, thank you, Michael, for your comments.
I think
we've lost your audio, Michael, so I'll let Aaron respond to what you said there.
I mean, the caller makes a good point, but the Iranians have managed to overcome the Sunni-Shia split, and they have deftly used their proxies, Hezbollah in Lebanon, which frankly poses far greater danger to Israeli security than Iran could ever pose. I mean, short of the nuclear, short of Iran attaining a nuclear weapon. I mean, it takes 12 minutes for a cruise missile to travel from Iran into Israeli airspace. Hezbollah's high trajectory weapons can reach Israel within 90 seconds. So proximity gives them an advantage of doing a lot of damage. But the Iranians have deployed Hezbollah successfully. They bankrolled Hamas, despite the fact that, yes, Hamas is a Sunni organization, you know, to the tune of $100 million a year. And they provided training, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, for Hamas's military fighters. And the Iranians have developed a relationship with the Houthis, a Zaydi sect, which controls a fair amount of Yemen, including its oil-producing facilities, and has managed 2 weeks ago to launch a drone 1,300 miles from Yemen into downtown Tel Aviv, which killed an Israeli. So these proxies can be quite useful in spreading Iran's message in the so-called Shia arc. And remember, I mean, Iran is led by a clerical regime now, but the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the military and the intelligence services are playing a much greater role in Iranian policy. So I think that the support for the proxies is going to continue.
Okay, we're already running out of time, so I'm just going to quickly read this note from Louisa to Aaron. I worked with Seeds of Peace some time ago. I wonder if you feel that this estimable organization has had any influence on the region as time has gone on. And if you could give a quick answer to Louisa, that'd be great.
Seeds is an extraordinary organization, and it can do transformational diplomacy. You watch these Israeli and Palestinian kids who, some of whom are traumatized, and they literally, after 3 weeks with follow-up support in the region, create space for the narrative of the so-called other. But it's saving the world one person at a time. You need governments to end conflict, to end killing, and to end conflict. And then organizations like Seeds of Peace have a critical role to play in shaping and molding the attitudes of a younger generation.
So Jackie, I'll give you a really huge question that I want you a 10-second answer for. Is there hope? Is there reason for optimism in the Middle East?
Yes, we were talking about this the other day, Aaron and I, and we looked at what happened in South Africa. It just couldn't happen. It took, as Aaron said, it took two great leaders. But if there are people that put them the country above themselves, then yes, I think there could be. But it does, it's not going to happen tomorrow.
That's a big caveat, yes, but good
Was that
answer.
10
Thank you.
seconds? Okay.
Yeah, that was great. And thank you both so much for joining us today. Jackie Northam, who you just heard, is NPR's international affairs correspondent specializing in foreign policy and global economics. And Aaron David Miller is a Middle East analyst and author, and he's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. A reminder that today's guests will be with journalist Martin Fletcher at the Freeport Performing Arts Center on August 27th, speaking on this topic. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.